Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
A press release for the book called What Got You Here Won't Get You There, subtitled How Successful People Become More Successful. That press release said of its author, Marshall Goldsmith, Marshall Goldsmith waives his usual $250,000 consulting fee to reveal the simple steps that readers can take right now to reach the next level in their careers, end quote. So I looked at the book and went one better. I gave it to my wife, Barbara Nemko, to look at. And our discussion about the book gave rise to rather a debate between she and I on, is it she and I, her and I? She and I.
She and I.
Yeah. She and I on how wise its core advice is. So I will share what that is in a minute. But without further ado, the Napa County Superintendent of Schools, Regional Superintendent of the Year, and now member of the State Superintendents of Schools Cabinet, Barbara Nemko. Welcome.
Thank you, I think.
So maybe you should, let's be honest.
Yes,
tell them about what's
full disclosure, this show is making me very nervous. I was delighted when Marty asked me to read this book, and I liked it a lot. In fact, I looked at the ideas that he talks about and identified a number of things that I need to improve on and thought about how I'm going to do those better. The problem is that the core principle of the book is the principle that Marty and I have been discussing, arguing over, debating for close to 40 years, and we've never reached agreement on it. So we're going to try and keep this discussion to a dull, polite roar or an interesting, polite fight. We'll try not to do that, but it makes me a little nervous.
And we will also try to invite you to leaven the proceedings a little later on after we lay out kind of the book's core arguments and have you weigh in whether you maybe more support Barbara's position, maybe more support my position, or want to amplify on either of the positions.
And I'd really be interested in people's experiences with bosses that do some of these things, or if they see something in themselves as they listen to this that they would like to change.
Okay, but first let's lay out the book's core point. If I can, let me lay it out, and first of all, you tell me if that's right, and you can amplify on it, etc. The book's core point is that successful people try too hard, and that we shouldn't try so hard to achieve our goals, to meet our fundraising target or our profit goal, at the expense of the people you're working around's feelings. First of all, am I accurate that that's kind of the core point of the book?
That is accurate. I would add something,
good,
but in adding something, I feel like I'm immediately violating one of his principles.
Which is why the principle is so crazy. Why you're not allowed to add. Go ahead.
I think his point is we should do less of many things, not keep trying to add things to what we're doing. He says, if you've been moderately successful, you already know how to do most things. What will keep you from getting to the next level is if you don't stop doing some of the things that are a barrier between you and your employees.
So he was saying in the case where I summarized the book, he would have simply say, don't add some clarification, just say thank you, is his point.
Good, yes, or just good
saying,
point.
Good point.
Good point.
Okay. And where our core disagreement is this. If all we do is simply say good point or thank you even when we disagree, which is something he says we should do more of, then nothing gets improved. There are many ideas that get brought up in the workplace that stand improvement. And it's not formally where it's a formal brainstorming session, but even in informal conversations where the right thing to say is tactfully, I can understand that's an interesting position. I'm wondering if we added this, or I'm wondering if that could fail because of that. If there were two clones of one workplace, we made two clones of it, and one that followed his core advice, that you should, wherever possible, simply say thank you, may spend more time nurturing your people, etc., and disagreeing as little as possible, not trying to. One of the first mistakes he says people make is add value, make mistake of adding value, do that less. I would argue that the workplace that followed his advice would likely be out of business if it was a for-profit business, or be an inefficient government agency or nonprofit if it couldn't be put out of business, or at least a government agency if it couldn't be put out of business. Do you and you disagree with that, Barb?
Yes, I disagree with it because I don't think he's as extreme as you perceive him. I think he's talking to people. Remember, he's a consultant who gets called in to improve somebody's work life. You don't call in a $250,000 consultant unless you're really having a problem at your workplace. So I think what he's saying is that if you are having difficulty, then look to some of these things to see if you do them all the time. Obviously, we're not expecting that people will never contribute an idea or add value. But if every utterance of someone on your team is met with you adding value, he says you disempower the team and people will be less interested in bringing up ideas because they know it's always going to be met with you making it your own. And so then they're not as bought in to wanting to make it happen.
If I can name drop, when I interviewed Jack Welch, who was the legendary CEO of GE, and let's put aside whether he cheated on his wife or not,
Did he cheat on his wife?
Yeah, I think
Oh, my goodness, he and Newt
like
could
that.
Talk.
Yeah, right.
That's just so irrelevant. I can't stand
right.
that it's out in the media.
I think nobody would argue that he brought countless numbers of good products to the public at an affordable price, that improve the quality of life for folks, as well as the value of the shareholders for all of us who have invested money or life savings, some of it in GE. But when I asked him what was the key to his being successful and GE being successful, he said it was because of the denigrating epithet that the media imposed on him. They called him Neutron Jack because he fired a higher percentage of people than the average CEO did. And in his evaluations, even with the people he kept, he was ruthlessly honest about their strengths and weaknesses. He said the key to GE's success was precisely the opposite of what this career coach, Marshall Goldsmith, says. As much as possible, he added value. That is, he did say, yes, but, or no, this isn't going to work, or no, you aren't doing well enough, or no, you better improve this, or you're fired. It's the opposite. It is the opposite of what Marshall Goldsmith is saying. And at least logically, it feels to me that such companies that adopted Jack Welch's approach rather than the Marshall Goldsmith approach will not only be more successful, but the people who work there and who survive the tough cuts are going to feel much more proud of the work that they're doing and of their teammates than if it's more like the millions of workplaces that exist more often in our country, which is we are not, and something that Jack Welch also said is we are not honest enough. We are so afraid of offending people that we're not honest in disagreement. We do say, oh, thank you, good point, thank you for sharing that with me. And we are very reluctant to give the negative feedback, to add the value that really in the end ultimately is best. I'll end by simply saying, I don't think Shakespeare was wrong, and I think it was Shakespeare who said it, when he said, the truth shall set you free. What do you think?
Certainly those are very good points. I can't completely disagree with them. I will violate his rule once again because we're having a discussion. It's certainly appropriate to evaluate your people and get rid of the ones who are not making the cut. Of course, that's always easier to do in a private workplace than it is in any kind of a public workplace where we have many union rules and regulations and procedures, and letting an employee go after they have achieve tenure is a very difficult thing to do and very costly. So I'm not sure that they're necessarily antithetical to one another. I think during the evaluation process, you should be evaluating and showing people where they're falling short and what you expect them to do and giving them goals to try to reach. That doesn't necessarily mean that every time they open their mouth in a meeting, you undercut them.
Where I think we can find common ground is this. I think there are a certain percentage of people, and you may have pointed it out to correct, the people who are going to hire a $250,000 consultant, which are corporations that have high-level executives who have a problem. Usually those people's problem is not their intelligence. It's because they haven't learned, they haven't gone to charm school. So I think maybe we can say that, dear listeners, and this is a way of tying this into the listeners, dear listeners, I don't know if it's, you know, 10% of people for whom this applies or 90, but if you or someone you work with does have those characteristics of constantly to prove how smart he or she is, or to establish power, or other non-productive reasons, is disagreeing too much, is valuing his own ego or her ego at the expense of what ultimately would be in the interest of the organization. Because indeed, if I have somebody listening to me and they make a good point, and I could, by adding some, quote, adding value, add five or 10%. But as Marshall Goldsmith in the book wrote, by my trying to add 5 or 10%, I may be decreasing the motivation of that person to implement his plan by 50%, then I should shut up. So in those cases, that feels absolutely legitimate. But what I'm arguing is that there is a far larger percentage of people in our workplaces in America that are too not honest, that are too eager to make nice, and that at this stage in American history, where self-esteem has been raised to primacy of to a level primary, even more lofty than achievement, that in this point in the arc of American history, this book is wrong. It's the right book for the wrong time. In the 1950s, when it was a strict top-down hierarchical, you should do this and you should do that, that is not today's workplace. So I would argue that, in fact, we need more honesty, not more tact. Barbara, I want to give you the last word, then we're going to go to the phones.
I certainly agree that the self-esteem movement was nuts. There are too many of us walking around with this self-esteem that we've painted on as though it were a blush and haven't earned it. There used to be a time when you had to achieve something to get self-esteem. Everything was not a participation award. And I think we went too far on that one. I think in terms of the time, though, he talks about the fact that if you are really a very bright employee and you're undercut all the time, you have the option of moving to some other workplace. And that's the dilemma that the boss faces, because once upon a time, if you moved around too much, you were considered flawed. Somebody who changed jobs every year was somebody that you didn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. Today, nobody stays in the workplace for 40 years in the same workplace, and it's considered a badge of success to be moving from place to place and moving up all the time. So you don't want to give your bright employees an incentive to move by making them feel that they are not valued. If somebody comes up with a great idea, there are lots of ways you can add value. Again, not 100% of the time. Sometimes you just have to say, that's great. And you can add value by saying, that's a great idea. What do you think about taking that and doing X, which is very different than that's a really good idea, but.
That's the couching argument, which I agree. I mean, nobody can argue for most of the time using a tactlessness, I think you're wrong, we should do this. the default mode, of course, should be that's a good idea, and I'm wondering whether it might even be better to do X, Y, or Z. Clearly, that's face-saving, and face-saving is critical.
Or what do you think of this idea? Do you think, that puts it back in their camp. They are the person who came up with the idea, and you give them credit for it. So even if the idea becomes adopted with your added value, it's really helpful if you always remind people, well, that was Marty's idea.
That is the formula you and I have mentioned often on this show, that the formula is, you know, I'm wondering whether, you know, good point, I'm wondering whether, blah, 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 what do you think? I mean, clearly that formula is a good formula to basically operate, unless, and again, everything, we're human beings, we're not electrons, we don't behave 100% predictably. There is sometimes a need for forgive the fancy term, disequilibration. There are some people who are so complacent that they are right all the time, that merely being super tactful does not disturb their undeserved complacency. And so sometimes, and I will admit it's rare, that a more direct, perhaps negative approach is necessary. Would you agree with that, first of all?
I would.
Okay.
There are other points that he makes, though, that are not quite that cut and dried. And I looked at one of them, for example, and saw myself in there and thought, I need to fix this. And that was what he calls habit number 9, withholding information.
Can we defer that? Because I want to go to the phones, because we laid out the core argument.
Sure.
And I wanted to get our listeners' reaction to the core argument.
I'd like their experiences with bosses who do either A or B.
Exactly. So the core arguments that we've made is we're trying to find some common ground so we don't, you know, it's Barbara's birthday on Tuesday, and I particularly did not want to end up fighting off the air. So we're trying to be on our best behavior in exemplifying model communication skills, even though we disagree. But the core basis for our basic positions is, Barbara thinks that we would have better workplaces if we were more, essentially, less eager to constantly add value and keep in mind the self-esteem of people as we give them feedback and be more tactful and be less focused on, be more focused on the people and less on the goal. And I would argue that ultimately, we have, in this point in American society, have gone too far the other way. It does give me pause, for example, that if one looks at studies of the most successful people, they have the lowest self-esteem on average, and that's by racial group as well as income. And the people with the lowest achievement by income and by racial group have the highest. That should give us a little warning that self-esteem often means complacency rather than this drive to feel like I'm never good enough. But that's kind of framing the argument. What do you think is better in what we need in the workplace, and what you've, as Barbara said, what you've experienced in your workplace? Is there a need for more honesty and directness, or is there a need for putting aside the goal-orientedness to some extent and the profit goals and the fundraising goals, et cetera, in favor of being more tactful and kind to people? The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, and we already do have calls on the line, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. What is on your mind? Hello.
Oh, hello. Hi,
it's you. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Calling from Bernal Heights. It's a rare occasion that I actually agree with Marty on this one. I had an experience with my work just this last Friday that I think falls right in line with what you're talking about here. And just a little background, I've worked in my job in a technical field as a system administrator for I'm in my 17th year. And a few years ago, we got my systems got outsourced to another company, and I went with them. So I'm working for a different company now in my third year with that company. And that company's very process-driven, and it's all about adding value and this and that. And in the last 6 months or so, I got a team lead watching over my group that tends to like to call a meeting and all hands. If there's a problem or an issue that's being worked on, he'll say, let's get everybody on a call. And so then my role suddenly comes from trying to solve the problem to trying to gather all the players, whether or not they all really need to be on the call immediately at that time. and sort of try and satisfy his, and then it becomes his issue almost to resolve with my sort of input. And this last Friday, this situation kind of happened, and I told him that, you know, whenever he calls a meeting like that, I feel like I've been defeated. I said, I've been doing this job a long time. I'm trying to coordinate the different players for any project that I'm working on, you know, as well as possible. And when he calls these meetings, I feel like I've been told basically that I failed, and that someone else needs to drive us to the result that we're looking for. And I said that I felt like it was, I don't feel like this too often because I like the company that I work for a lot, but I said I feel like it's one of the reasons that a lot of people leave the company that I'm working for, because they feel like, you know, they're not being given the sort of credit or consideration that they deserve for having been doing this so long. And, you know, I told him I appreciate his input, but I just feel like, after I said that to him, he sort of let me drive the process as well as we could. And you know, we couldn't get anywhere because I couldn't get all the key players on the call. And whenever this kind of situation happens, I end up spending as much time trying to explain to him, getting him up to speed on it as I would if I were just, you know, I could better devote that time to actually resolving the issue.
You know, Tom, much as I hate to say it, because you certainly damn me with faint praise, you started by saying, you know, it's very rare I agree with you, but in this case I do. But, you know, if I'm to be honest about things, you're agreeing with Barbara, because you're criticizing your boss for attempting to add value rather than giving you the autonomy to do it yourself. You're agreeing with Barbara, am I not wrong?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Maybe I misunderstood your positions on it somewhat.
Well, good. You got a perfect track record. Now you can continue disagreeing with me all the time.
As you were talking...
Well, you know, you tend to take the side of the person that's going to be doing the enforcing, and I didn't think you were doing that in this case, but I was mistaken. But you tend to sort of err on the side of, like when you talk about government, well, government's bad. Any government's bad. Business could be better. And I think there's just a role for government and society, and to say that any business could accomplish government tasks better than government is just kind of looking at it through with blinders on.
At the risk of...
Anyway...
That's a technique...
So my boss and I ended up having a good conversation, my team lead, really. We have a good relationship, and he's a really nice guy, and his whole persona is very generous and appreciative, and I like working with him. But I just don't want to – I want him to work with me in those kinds of situations instead of sort of taking the situation out of my hands and taking it over, basically. So
thank you for the call,
you know,
Tom.
One last thing is that he happens to be an Indian worker that's here in the U.S. Working for the company that I work for, having come here for the last few years and doing the work out of a U.S. City. So you know, there's the little cultural
there
kind
are.
Of thing where...
No question.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tom, thanks for the call. That is an interesting point about the, you know, there are very different values among the Asian clients. There are many exceptions, but, you know, in terms of how important tact is in business, but we won't go there. But what was interesting, when he says, you always think, you know, that is sometimes this black and white thinking is very dangerous. He characterized my position that government is always bad and business is always good. I think it's fair to say that it's not what I believe. I do think there are some built-in liabilities to both business and government, and I will leave to another day the exploration of those. But to characterize somebody as a black and white of that, just I couldn't let that stand without at least a brief, non-distractive protest of disagreement. Anyway, Barbara, you were saying, however, before the break, I'll go back to the phone number though again. Do you believe in your? I want to kind of couch it more simply, if you will. This book by Marshall Goldsmith, which is called "What Got You Here Won't Get You There: How Successful People Can Become More Successful." His core position is that leaders and managers and basically all of us in the workplace would do better if we focused not so much on goal achievement, but more being kinder to people and being less goal-oriented. And so I'm curious if you think that that is a better approach, or being tougher on people at this point and focusing on the facts of the matter and giving feedback where necessary is a better approach. I'd welcome your opining as well as telling your story of what's going on in your workplace. 415. And yeah, and I'll also broaden up. If you'd like a 3-minute career makeover, you can call in as well. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before we took the call, Barbara, you said that there was one of his Marshall Goldsmith's rules that you feel you'd like to work on, which is withholding information. Tell me about that.
Actually, I saw several, but we'll start with this one. He talks about the person who withholds information as not someone who means to. None of us like to feel out of the loop. And he says, think about the last time you realized there was a meeting that you weren't told about, or a memo or an email on something that you feel is sort of in your purview that you weren't copied on, or when you realize you were the last person to hear about something that's going on in the organization. That feels awful. And he says he went into a workplace where that was a problem between the boss and the boss's assistant. So he walked in to observe how the office ran. The boss would typically get in 15 minutes before the assistant, and the first thing that he would do is turn on, I don't know if it's he or she, I'm saying he, but it could have been a she, turn on the email and start responding. And then the phone would ring, and the boss would pick up the phone and be talking, and then another call would come in. The assistant would come in, and the boss would be on the phone, kind of wave at the assistant, and go back to doing all the things that were going on. And this went on throughout the morning until all of a sudden the boss needed something and the assistant didn't know about it because he hadn't had time to organize his thoughts and sit down with the assistant and say, these are the things we're working on today or this week. These are the big things. So what do we need to get ready for it? It wasn't that he was deliberately trying to withhold information. He just got himself absorbed in his own work and didn't take the time. And I think about that. I do that.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. How many times have you complained to me that you're sick and tired of getting copied on emails on things that you really don't have a need to know?
Oh, absolutely. The kinds of emails where somebody sends out a notice and they say, we want to have a meeting. Are you available on this or that day? And 40 people respond to everybody. That to me is insane. And I don't want to get everybody's email, but where it relates to me, I do want to get it. I don't want to be the last one to know.
No question that on a need-to-know basis, it's important to, obviously. It doesn't require any author, let alone a $250,000 consultant, to tell you. You give people information as they need to know it.
But let me give you an example of the kind of information I'm talking about, why I think I need to improve.
Okay, let me first respond to what you just read. And then you said that this boss went and started answering his emails, took some phone calls or whatever, rather than meeting with her to clue her in. Well, it seems to me that a lot of the time that the assistant, and he's talking about her, his assistant, doesn't need to know all of that stuff. Sure, you know, have a major agenda for the week or the day may or may not be necessary if she's not involved. Sometimes his work doesn't require informing her. So I'm not sure that any kind of a blank statement. I think every one of us is overwhelmed with too much information, and I think it is the wise leader who says, I'm only going to share with somebody what they really need to know, not only to do their job, but to feel invested. Yes, they need to know the general where the company is headed in the next month or whatever so that they feel part of it. But I think I worry that there's too much information being exchanged, not too little. Now, Barbara, tell me what you're referring to.
I find sometimes because I haven't shared what's happening today or tomorrow or the next day, that all of a sudden I have a need for something that I didn't realize I needed, and then it becomes an emergency for Nancy to try and make that happen. For example, the other day, I suddenly realized we were having a meeting and all these people were coming in and we needed to have copies of things for all of them. She would have realized that if I had told her in the morning, we're having this meeting at 11 o'clock. She would have said, What do you need for the meeting? Are you doing handouts? Are you doing this? Do we need coffee? Do we need to reserve a room for a week from now when you do the follow-up to this meeting? All of those things shouldn't catch her by surprise because I have forgotten to sit down and share. These are the things that we're going to be working on this week. I don't have that organized a mind.
Okay.
Nancy does.
Question.
And I make her job more difficult when I don't give her that advance notice.
Let's turn to another example of one of his two really core tips, he being Marshall Goldsmith, author of What Got You Here Won't Get You There, How Successful People Become More Successful. He, of course, makes the obvious warning to minimize personal put-downs. He says, though the question, though, is not whether to put somebody down. Is it worth it? Is the benefit to derive with it? And that's great. And so that makes perfect sense. But now, here's where I fail and you succeed. You're a very calm person by nature. Your heart rate doesn't go up, and so you tend to be impulsive. Mine, when I'm annoyed at somebody, I don't have a temper. That's not me. But I can be critical of somebody when I feel that there's somebody, especially if they're being lazy or lying or whatever. If you're counseling me, who doesn't have this completely, a very flat personality, how would you counsel me when I'm feeling that a person is either lied or is lazy or is excuse-making, passing the buck to everybody else when he or she is responsible? How would you – you have any advice for me how I can better retain perspective and so I can stay very, very measured in how I respond?
I wouldn't respond until I gave it 24 hours. Write yourself a note. I really need to talk to so-and-so about such-and-such, but I'm not going to do it right now because right now I'm going to say things that I might be sorry for.
Okay. I'm going to give out the phone number in a minute, but I guess I'll give out the phone number now, and then I have some more questions I'd like to ask you about the book.
I think people are afraid they'll get in the middle of our fight.
Well, I think we've demonstrated reasonable. We have not been unduly harsh on each other.
Yes, we're actually still going to be speaking to each other at the end of the show.
Right. So, dear listeners, whether you want to weigh in on the relative value of directness versus tact in your workplace and how it's played out, or if you would like a 3-minute career makeover because you're having some difficulty in today's job market, or self-employment, you need some self-employment help, or some guidance on how to deal better with your boss. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The book says to apologize more. It one of its 20 things was a pay-on to the value of apologizing. But I have found that apologizing exerts a great price. It legitimizes when somebody admits, I was wrong, I made a mistake. It takes whatever doubt there might have been that the person had screwed up and legitimizes it. I actually, this morning, in preparing for the show, made a list of some of the most famous apologies in history. And I'd like to read them all to you. And I think you will see, and I'm more than willing to hear your disagreement, that it did not help them and may have even hurt them. As I said, it kind of put the final nail in the coffin. It eliminated all doubt. Richard Nixon apologized for Watergate. Did we forgive him? Hardly. When Don Imus apologized for calling the Rutgers women's basketball team, I'm just going to say, a derogatory term, we didn't forgive him. It solidified our belief that he was egregiously wrong. When Jimmy Swaggart, the revival preacher, in tears apologized, I have sinned. Did we forgive him? No. He became the butt of ever more jokes. When Bill Clinton apologized at a prayer meeting in Washington, D.C. for his cigar incident with Monica Lewinsky, he became more, unfortunately, and Bill Clinton had a lot of excellent qualities, he has become probably, he will go down as more remembered for that than anything else. When you look at Larry Craig, the guy who apparently was a gay senator who was had sex in a bathroom in an airport and apologized, it did not make the problem go away. Elliot Spitzer with the high-priced prostitute. Marion Jones, the Olympic runner who apologized for using steroids. Tiger Woods for cheating on his wife. One of my street-smart clients said to me, she says, always deny. that you're always never sure. If you deny, they can't really nail you as easily. What's your honest... The book says, apologize, apologize, but what I'm saying is, when you apologize, you're paying a very big price, often in excess of the value of the apology. What is your honest reaction to that?
Pragmatically, if they catch you with semen stains on the blue dress that can be traced back to you, denial is not an option. I'm not sure. Do we have examples of people who refused to apologize and what happened to them? In the meantime, Bill Clinton had a two-term presidency, and a lot of people remember him as somebody who really got us on the road to financial stability in this country, where we had a surplus, where if we hadn't gone into all those wars, we wouldn't be in the position we're in now.
Taking a liberal and conservative example, the president of GM has lost billions of dollars. Has he apologized to the American people for the fact that that we bought $50 billion of stock that's now worth $24 when we would break even at 53? He hasn't apologized. He just goes on saying, we're the new GM. When we have spent trillions of dollars in stimulus, has the government that passed the trillion-dollar stimulus said, we made a mistake, or no, we need more stimulus? You know, I don't think apology very often, of course, sometimes it works.
Good
when,
point.
When there's no way of avoiding
it. Those are great examples.
So, again, the book, I feel, is a little out of touch with what works in the real world today. Another example, but I want to be positive before I go to the phones. One more example, I want to end on a positive note before I go to the phones. One of my favorite suggestions in the book is, be sure that your supervisees, the people who work for you, who suck up to you, don't get better treatment than they deserve. But that's so hard. We won't want to be liked. So any thoughts about, first of all, that suggestion? That's one of, you know, beware of the suck up. Don't treat him badly, but don't treat him or her better than they deserve on the merits. Any thoughts about whether you agree and how to resist that temptation that we all have to like people who like us?
Well, when you're in a public workplace, I don't think you can treat them differently in terms of job promotions and things. Do you treat them differently in terms of interpersonal relationships? Of course you do. The person who is friendly and is always saying, how are you today?
How wonderful you are. That's what a suck-up is.
But
how do you not promote? We rationalize saying we want to promote people who like us because they work better with us. They're more in sync. Their approach to work is more in sync with ours. You know, and when in fact that could be a rationalization. Is that not true?
Probably can. For the most part, I don't sit in on the hiring interviews so that I'm not interjecting my opinions into that. The people who are supervising that department would do that. And again, you're right. It's hard to avoid that bias. You just have to be aware that you are judging the person not just on the fact that they're really nice. Because I have made that mistake too, hiring somebody that was really nice that turned out to be not a good hire. So, yeah, it's certainly something you need to be aware of.
On that point of agreement, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What is on your mind? It's your turn.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, thank you very much. Something happened early in the show, and I was curious about it. It's in relationship to the situation at work where, if there is a boss, then there always is some sort of problem in an employee seeming to disagree with the boss and getting anxious from it. But it relates to this, in this connection, and I don't see why it would have come up. At the very beginning of the show, Barbara, for whom I have great respect, and I have respect for you too, Marty,
thank you,
said that she was very nervous because she knew that you and she were going to disagree. And I wondered why that made her nervous.
Good. It's a good question. Only because we have been fighting about this very topic for many years. The core of it, which is whether
unwanted advice.
Right, whether it's appropriate to give advice when you're not asked. That's how we fight about it. In this book, it's called adding value all the time.
Right.
Has gotten us into a lot of fights.
But
and
you,
so
it wouldn't be that you really were like nervous because you were going to disagree with Marty. I mean, you've been together for God knows how many years, right?
Right.
Oh, absolutely. I just don't want us to be fighting.
Right.
There are times when we have left the show and we're personally fighting. And
fighting is too strong. We're arguing.
Arguing.
Bit, yeah.
This is supposed to be a discussion about a book that has relevance for other people, and I didn't want us to get into a personal thing.
Thank you very much.
Well, there's a generalized point to the audience. I'm really glad you called, and I want to explain. The core is there are two schools of thought about unwanted advice. There are some who say it is disempowering to give unwanted advice. When they want advice, they will ask for it. And that is Barbara's core. You know, she doesn't believe it to the extreme, but that is a core position that she holds. I believe that if you see a problem, something that exists in somebody or in something, it is almost an obligation to tactfully bring it up. So that, for example, if somebody, even some of my career counseling clients, if they have bad breath, they have not asked me about their bad breath problem, they're not aware of it, but I will routinely bring it up. Or even if it's not somebody who's paying me, if I were to see somebody in the workplace making an error that they're unaware of that was hurting their career or their personal life or whatever, I would feel ethically, cosmically good about bringing it up. And Barbara would be more hesitant about doing that. That's the core basis of our argument. And it's in terms of my giving advice to Barbara. This is not just in the abstract. When I see something that I think Barbara should consider, I don't ram it down her throat, but I am happy to say, Barbara, you know what? I think it would be smart for you to do X, Y, or Z. That's what it's about. Okay, I guess he's gone. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. It is your turn on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Barbara. My name is Rona, and I'm a parent educator, temperament counselor, and a radio show host.
Ah.
And I'm listening to you guys, and I feel like I keep coming back to when I work with parents, and I listening to both of you, I realize that it reminds me a lot of parenting style differences. And in the workplace, you know, bosses are very different based on their style. And I think it's a mistake to get too opposed. You're sort of as the opposite. And it's not about one or the other. Just like in parenting, there's this middle ground that when we're really mindful and paying attention and not too stressed, and Barbara, you know this in the education field as well, and you too, Marty, it's like there are times when it's appropriate to say something, and there are times when it's really important with a child to let them kind of be the lead, make some mistakes, and then come back in and do a little Aikido with them. And I think, and I want to respond to the other thing you were saying about spinning things and don't apologize. That kind of got my goat a little. Because I think when you're talking about politics and marketing folks who want to spin things to manipulate people, it's very different than as a boss or a parent when you do something that doesn't seem quite right, to be able to go like, you know, I realize that didn't work so well. I'm sorry. And let's try this instead. So I think there's a lot of integrity sometimes in apologizing, as long as it doesn't become your style where the next thing you know, you're apologizing about everything. So does this remind you of sort of parenting styles as well?
Absolutely. It reminds me of any human interaction is fraught with potential to screw up. And I think what he said to me in this, what I took from this book was all of this is only a problem if it's a problem. If you are somebody who always adds value, but your employees don't mind it, it's not a problem. It's if you're having a problem with them that you need to look and see what is the cause and how can I fix it. And so we are trying very hard to find some middle ground, which is what you do when you're a parent and you're working with kids. And I very much liked your distinction between the political world and the real world.
Yeah, and I think what's important, too, is you know, that mindfulness about yourself. You know, if I am interrupting a lot and telling people what to do a lot as a boss, if I could notice that and make some change, and we all know how hard that is, but I think a book like that, probably you kind of take the parts that fit for you and you reject the other parts. And I think, Marty, you know, in your work, you probably do that all the time. You know, you probably are a little bit more middle ground than you're sounding this morning.
That was, I think we both, I'm sorry that I'm not sounding middle ground enough. I do think that we are at a point, at least from my judgment, in this stage of the evolution of American values, where we are in too many workplaces, not just in politics, focusing more on the preservation of self-esteem than the search
right.
for truth.
And, yeah, and truth is really good, and it depends on how it's done, right?
Right. Anyway, on that point of agreement, I thank you very much for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi. My name's Kelly, and I'm calling. I'm going to kind of take you guys back a little bit to the beginning of trying to get into a management career and that sort of thing. Everything that you guys are talking about, I'm studying in my MBA program right now. And the reason that at 39 years old, I've gone back and decided to get my MBA is because I'm trying to make the leap from working in healthcare, working in sales in healthcare, to going to management and practice management. The problem I'm running into, though, is that I can't really make that leap because of what's happening kind of in the hiring right now. The New York Times the Wall Street Journal recently did an article about how everybody is looking for somebody with 7-10 years experience,
right.
and they don't
right.
want to take someone
yep.
who, you know, maybe has 1 year, 2 years.
Yep.
And I don't know how I'm going to get that 7-10 years experience. I feel like my core values and what I have learned so far are in the right place for what I want to do, and I'm taking the steps as far as going back and getting my MBA, but I'm even wondering if I'm wasting my time because of this 7-10 years experience of management that everybody wants me to have. Where am I supposed to get it?
Okay, great question. I'm delighted that you called. A couple of possibilities. First of all, you kept about three times you mentioned that your core values are in the right place. In today's world, well, first of all, you're not hopeless, but it's going to require extraordinary effort. In this economy, indeed, because there are so many, there's what's called a fancy term called disintermediation, where so many corporations are getting rid of middle management, there are relatively few new jobs, and if they do want to hire somebody, they've got a million people who are laid off who've got 7 to 10 years experience. Why would they try somebody, take their chance with somebody who has no experience? So you indeed are in an almost unprecedentedly difficult job market. But so you have to compensate for the lack of 7 to 10 years experience with some extraordinary things. And there are people who've had no experience and are 1 or 2 years experience who do get hired over people with 7 to 10 years experience. But here are some of the ways in which you can become that exceptional person. Number one, what you were bringing to the table was this: I've got the right values, the core values. Values are all well and good, but frankly, in this job market, those are assumed. The person who gets hired is somebody who has the combination of both technical expertise and leadership expertise. If you are a master at understanding, and you don't have to be a PhD-level scientist, but if you are working in selling healthcare products, you need to know the science well enough that you can communicate between the techies and with the investment analysts and with the non-techies. You've got to have the goods. That's critical. Secondly, with regard to the MBA, I believe that in this, we live in an era of degree proliferation in which, because the brand name universities from Wharton to Harvard all know that an MBA is a profit center, because the employers are often paying to have their employees get an MBA, and therefore they can charge $150,000, there is now, in 2012, an oversupply of MBAs. So unless you are truly a superstar among your fellow MBA students and are going to a brand name institution where you stand out and the professors say, wow, I'm going to really tout this student, or your fellow students say, hey, I want to start a startup with you because you're brilliant, the MBA is usually not worth the time and money. Better to try to, even if it's a lower level job,
get to have some minor management experience where you can hone both your technical skills and leadership skills and the communication skills we've talked about so that you can be superior as an applicant to the dozens of people with 7 to 10 years of experience that the Wall Street Journal or New York Times talks about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely does. Do you think that I think you're right.
Okay.
So you think that the MBA, and I'm not going to, a big name school for an MBA. I'm doing it locally at Golden Gate University.
Yeah.
While I work.
That's so expensive. My view would be I would take... The reason that people go to school is because without the structure and discipline that is provided by the school setting, most people do not use their discretionary time well. If you are a kind of a self-starter that would take the time and money that you would otherwise spend fulfilling the requirements of the courses and et cetera at Golden Gate, and instead say, I am going to do informational interviews with great people, I am going to go and volunteer to help people in interesting companies on a small project, I'm going to take short-term seminars from the leading practitioners in the field. If you're enough of a self-starter to do those things, I would argue, there's no guarantees, but that your chances are greater of being one of the relatively small percentage of managerial wannabes who would get hired than if you're just another average MBA from Golden Gate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's great advice.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Nemko. Let's take one more call, and then I want to spend the last few minutes bringing this, the advice of the book to very practical terms. You said that you're going to actually try to change some things yourself in the workplace. Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. What is on your mind?
Is that me?
Hello, it is.
Yeah. Hi, Marty. I want to side with you on the part about not being, you don't want to be mean, but I like to...
Never mean. I always said you can be direct and still be face-saving and tactful. There is very rarely an argument for being mean.
Exactly. Well, I like people to... I tell everybody... Tell me something, even if I don't want to hear it, I'd rather hear it. Mm-hmm. And as long as they're not downright mean, that's fine. I have a new workplace where I actually, the person who I answer to is exactly like me that way, and it's heaven because there's only enough time to do the job, and there's only enough time to be direct. And I learned a long time ago that it's never about me. I'll say, does the job need... Does what I did need more or less attention? I don't say, how did I do? I said, does this need more or less attention? And how so? And then it's just the facts. And this person who I answer to is just such a joy. And I think if I ever hire someone, and I do run my own business, if I ever hire someone, I'm going to take the time to find people exactly like me that way. Because it's nothing about myself. I have to take such good care of myself that I'm emotionally resilient, and I don't, I'm not reactive. And I've learned so much that way, and it means that my service is a lot more in demand.
Because exactly.
People can count on me to just get the job done, and knowing that I feel good in myself, and they get what they need.
I think that is a great point. If we can depersonalize the work process and say, what can get this job done well? Paradoxically, we will all feel better as human beings than if we're constantly processing the feelings and being and withholding information and being tactful and just saying thank you when we really want to say, I don't agree with your idea. I very much appreciate your call. I find that a great punctuation mark for the end of this segment. But Barbara, I want to just turn to one thing. In the book, talks about the criticality of something that we've all feel we should do and none of us do, which is a 360 evaluation. You know, we all think we behave a certain... None of us think we're tactless. We all think we strike the right balance between goal orientation and people orientation. Do you have any advice about how to get Barbara Nemko, rather than generally, what could make you... I saw your face scrunch up even as I said it. What could make Barbara Nemko go to her supervisees, her coworkers, et cetera, and ask for an anonymous, and they do this, there's a software that enables us to do this anonymously called Checkster.com, that would enable you to motivate you to actually get that 360-degree feedback so you can know really what the, at least your coworkers think you need to work on?
I get them frequently from other people, and they always annoy me. And that's my lack, which is the reason that I...
You mean a request? You get a request for a 360
evaluation. Right, somebody is doing a 360
evaluation. Why does that annoy you?
It always feels, as though they think they're so important they have to...
Wow.
I admit this is my lack, and so I probably should do it. My problem would be if it came back very positive, I would think they're all sucking up. So I don't know if I would get total honesty, but I think it's a really good idea. I know.
Checkster.com.
I know.
Okay, let's turn it.
I will commit to doing it.
Wow. Wow.
That and making sure I'm not withholding information.
Great.
Inadvertently, but nonetheless, it has the same effect.
Sounds great. I want to give you the last word. Is there anything more you would like to say about the book? It could either be a summary statement or something new that we haven't yet talked about. From the book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, How Successful People Become More Successful.
I'm going to talk about something that we haven't mentioned, and that is one of the habits he says, which is not listening.
Oh, yeah.
Guilty, 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 guilty. I know that I don't listen tremendous amount of the time. My mind is always running to seven other things that are going on, and that's rude. That's disempowering. It also means that a lot of times then I'm lost because I don't know how to answer the question because I didn't hear everything that led up to it. And that's, I think, for many of us who all complain that I can't remember anybody's name. It isn't that we can't remember their name. It's that we don't pay attention when we're introduced. It's that not listening all the time. And so that's another thing that I am going to make an effort to do better.
Listening is one of the, it has a dangerous combination of feeling like it's easy to do and in fact being really hard to do for reasons you mentioned and others. The notion of listening carefully to not just what they're saying, but what they're not saying, changes in their body language, not jumping ahead, you know, even if you're fully focused on them, you very smart people like you know what they're probably going to be saying before they finish saying
it.
Or, but usually we're right. But the price we pay for interrupting is so heavy that it's usually, even if we do know exactly what they're going to say, it's worth not disempowering them and just listening. And if you're afraid you're going to forget what you're going to say, to even take a note. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's one of the skills I wish we taught kids. We assume that because somebody's sitting and their eyes are on us, that they're actually listening. And we all know how much we tune out in classes. I think we learn how to not listen in school.
And on that point of agreement, that is Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute career makeovers, workovers, whatever you want to call them. And no guest. You're stuck with me for the whole hour. I will share, however, my favorite new career tips, workplace tips. And until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara Nemco, reminding you that we do find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.